I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, it's a monster-sized edition of Parallax Views. As we continue our Reflections on Afghanistan series, this time with two guests joining us, J.P. Satilli, otherwise known as The News Vandal, our journalist friend who's appeared on the show multiple times at this point, and first-time guest, the esteemed Matthew Ho, a former Marine and State Department official who blew the whistle on the 2009 surge in Afghanistan. Trust me when I say this is a fascinating three-way conversation that you're not going to want to miss. It builds off of our previous conversations with J.P. Satilli dealing with the Empire of Oil, and goes very in-depth, providing a fuller picture of geopolitics in the aftermath of the Afghanistan withdrawal. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. Welcome back to Parallax Views. J.P. Satilli, and also joining us, Matthew Ho of the Center for International Policy and a whistleblower from the days of the surge in Afghanistan. I want to start with you, Matthew, in case I have younger listeners that are unfamiliar with your work at the State Department and the issues with the surge. Could you maybe fill them in?
Sure. And thank you for having me here, JG. This is great. So I was in the Marine Corps for 10 years. I was in the Iraq War twice and then also worked on Iraq policy and operations issues at both the State Department and the Pentagon. And then in 2009, I had an appointment into the Foreign Service and went to Afghanistan as a political officer, where I saw that, the war was no fundamentally different than the Iraq War. The war really was for the war was for purposes that you could primarily deduce as domestic political purposes for the United States. No different in the Obama administration than you had in the Bush administration. And then there are so many other aspects of the wars that were similar. But after being there for 5 months, seeing the escalation of the Afghan war by the Obama administration, I resigned in protest of that escalation. It's important to understand how what occurs in Afghanistan. President Obama campaigns on it as the good war, that he is going to win the good war. This way he's able to portray the Iraq war and paint the Republicans with it as the dumb war. And he is not going to make the mistake that the Republicans made, and he will finish what should have been finished years ago. So President Obama comes into office, and during this time, he says that he is going to send two more brigades to Afghanistan, which is roughly about 10,000 soldiers. There is all kinds of talk as well that we will find a political solution to the war. General Petraeus famously says this in the fall of 2008 when he takes over Central Command. It's very clear, though, as soon as Obama takes office, that's not the plan. That's not as what happens. The concern is to show President Obama, similar to what was being said in the campaign trail, that a Black Democrat can be a better commander-in-chief, a better warfighter than a white Republican can. I mean, that's a lot of, I think, what the messaging was, that the White House was trying to get out of winning the war. And so rather than sending two brigades of soldiers, within the first 7 months of being in office, Barack Obama sends 40,000 U.S. soldiers. So when Barack Obama comes into office, there are 30,000 U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, roughly the same amount of contractors and NATO forces. Within a year and a half of taking office, there are 100,000 U.S. forces in Afghanistan, 40,000 NATO forces, and more than 100,000 contractors. So you're talking about a 250,000 man army Barack Obama puts into Afghanistan to win the war. And that is basically what the surge is. There are all kinds of explanations for it. You've heard Joe Biden speak recently about the counter-terrorist strategy versus the counterinsurgency strategy. And that's, you know, the main thing is that for almost the entire 20 years of the war in Afghanistan, with the exception of the last 2 years of the Trump administration, where Donald Trump chooses to negotiate with the Taliban, again, for his own political purposes and his own ego, rather than for actually ending the war, the benefit of the Afghans, et cetera, gaining stability in the region, any of that, you know. But the policy of the United States in Afghanistan was one simply of military victory. And the consequences of that is defeat. And this is what defeat looks like.
So real quick, too, if we could, can you also discuss what led to you sort of blowing the whistle? I mean, you were featured in the New York the Washington Post after you came out against the surge. What led you to come out?
Well, you know, by the time I got to Iraq, I was morally and intellectually broken. I mean, all the excuses, the rationales I had for taking part in, I'm sorry, by the time I got to Afghanistan, I was morally and intellectually broken. All the excuses and rationales I had for taking part in these wars, you know, they couldn't hold up for very long when I dealt with the reality of it. And this is not to say, by no means am I saying I've got some stronger moral compass than anyone else. You know, I was criminally complicit with these wars for 12 years. And speaking now is just an attempt for me to repent or atone for that. And I say these things just to encourage other folks who might be out there struggling with the same types of things, struggling with the guilt and the shame and the regret of having taken part in these wars. So getting to Afghanistan in 2009, April 2009, seeing that the war was no fundamentally different than Iraq, all my excuses haven't been worn through, all my rationalizations for taking part. I will also say that there's actually, I think, a fairly significant part of this is that when I was home, when I was not in the wars, I was medicating myself with alcohol. I was, in order to keep the demons at bay, right, to accept myself, to deal with the moral injury I was going through, I was medicating with alcohol. And I think that medication, by alcohol, was in effect like, you know, like Roundup. I was keeping the weeds down in my mind, right? That allowed me to, my intellectual and moral honesty of the war, that allowed me to like kind of subjugate that, keep that in chains, keep it behind door in my brain. And right, I mean, but when I get to Afghanistan, I can't drink. And so I think those weeds brought up, and I don't know how accurate that is, but that's just what I've been thinking about. And I feel like that had a lot to do with the fact that I didn't have a substance to accept myself, to make myself numb, to, again, keep chained that intellectual and moral honesty. But seeing everything in Afghanistan, no different than Iraq, people will say, well, what about the terrain? What about the people? What about the ethnicities, the culture? But you're missing the forest for the trees, you know, because the only thing that mattered in Afghanistan was the same thing that mattered in Iraq. The U.S. military was there in a massive presence, was using a divide and conquer strategy and was trying to achieve a military victory via an occupation. And, you know, so yeah, seeing the support that the United States gave to the drug lords, the Afghan government, basically, who controlled the drug trade, seeing the brutalization of the people, the fact that the Pashtun people, who are a plurality in the country, and up until this past year, made up probably 95% of the Afghan insurgency, you know, the Taliban, and that's one thing I think that people have not really understood or looked at. The Taliban in the last year have really expanded. It may be a passive base of support. It's a transactional base of support. You know, these people are not card-carrying members of the Taliban. However, they have looked at the situation, people all throughout Afghanistan, non-Pashtuns, and said, you know what, the Taliban is a better alternative to the government. You know, and this is what occurs. We in 2001, we replace a theocratic repressive government with a kleptocratic repressive government. They rule, they prey on the people for 20 years, and now you see large elements of support among the population for the Taliban because the status quo with the government is untenable. It doesn't mean they support the Taliban. No, it does not at all. But what it means is that this is the consequences of a policy that for 20 years, by the barrel of a rifle, we said to the Afghan people, you get to choose. You get to choose between the Taliban or this government of warlords.
And I also wanted to ask, in regards to, since we were talking about Obama and we were talking about Trump, and we'll talk about Biden as well, and also, we can't leave Bush out of this, really, can we? But
I mean, we can go back to Nixon, man. I mean, this is, we can go back to Nixon. I mean, this is, you know, it's like any type of history. Where do you choose to begin? And that's one of the things I think that's so frustrating and so demonstrates the willingness of the American corporate media to go along with this war, to manufacture consent, is because all this week, from what I've seen, I mean, maybe I'm missing some discussions, but it's as if the history of Afghanistan starts on May 1st when Joe Biden says he's going to pull 2,500 troops out, and that the collapse of the government, the collapse of the army, the taking of Kabul, has everything to do with Joe Biden pulling 2,500 troops out of a country the size of Texas. Afghanistan is 250,000 square miles. That's one soldier for every 100 square miles, as if there was some thin red line of GIs all around the country that were like holding off the Taliban, right? But that's the starting point for the discussion. And you don't get any of, you know, not just even the last 20 years, but any of the time before. So yeah, absolutely. But I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, I just wanted to add to that too. I think I'm frustrated at times because we're hearing a lot of concerns about women's rights and girls' rights in Afghanistan mm-hmm. right now. But I feel like we're not talking about things like, you know, if I ask someone, do you know who the Hazaras are? I will often just get blank stares. And, you know, I don't think the Taliban's going to be very nice to the Hazaras. And I feel like there's just a lack of education about Afghanistan and its people. It's a pretty diverse country of people. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Matthew, and then I want to get JP's opinion on that as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it is. It's I think according to the Afghan constitution, there are 13 official languages and 40 official ethnicities and more than that, particularly languages, much more than that, I believe. I mean, there are parts of Afghanistan where within valleys that are 20 miles long by 3 miles wide, they speak their own language. I mean, that is the reality of Afghanistan. It is, but at the same time too, I have never met an Afghan who has identified as their ethnicity first, who has ever identified as anything other than Afghan. So while it is a very diverse country, it has been destroyed by divide and conquer strategies that the Soviet Union utilized to a bit, but the Americans have really utilized. And when you think of divide and conquer strategies, you can think about American history going all the way back, right, to the colonists and the crown, you know, before this country was founded. You know, pitting Native American tribes against one another. You know, certainly what we saw in Iraq, where, you know, I witnessed this firsthand, Sunnis were pitted against Shia, were pitted against Kurds, right? I mean, that divide and conquer strategy. The frustration with the lack of understanding about Afghanistan, the knowledge of it, you know, and I know before we started this, JP made the comment about women, and I'm sure, you know, he's going to add more to that. And that's an incredibly important thing to discuss. And it's undoubtable. It's absolutely, yes, absolutely true that in parts of Afghanistan, the life of women has gotten remarkably better. Particularly in certain neighborhoods and some cities, completely different than it was in 2001 for the better. And that extends for men as well, because men now have access and they can travel, education. However, what we know though is that 75% of the country lives outside the city. And even within the cities, there are haves and have-nots. Afghanistan is incredibly poor. 70% of the country lives on less than $1 a day. And that under the Afghan government, the warlord government that we put in power, these are the warlords that actually brought the burqa to Kabul. The burqa is a head-to-toe covering. In Afghanistan, it's typically blue and it covers the face. And the warlords were the people who brought that to Kabul in 1994. The Taliban don't take Kabul to 1996. These same warlords who are also rocketing, shelling Kabul and massacring tens of thousands of people. So, but under this Afghan government of warlords, yes, the Taliban, I mean, this government has not been as bad as the Taliban. And they certainly have not been as theatrical in their misogyny as the Taliban. They are not stoning women in stadiums, no. But the reality is, the last 20 years in Afghanistan, 4 out of 5 Afghan women are forcibly married, they often as child brides. Men are legally allowed to rape their wives. And the majority of women who are in Afghan prisons are not in Afghan prisons because they support the Taliban, but because they have committed moral crimes. Moral crimes, meaning that if you are an Afghan woman and you are raped, you will be put in prison. Look, I know I was in Afghanistan for 5 months, and outside of Kabul, I was in 5 different provinces over 5 months, as well as Kabul. And outside of Kabul, in those 5 provinces over 5 months, I saw a total of 2 women outside of their homes. That was it. You can talk to guys and gals who were over there, spent 9 months, 10 months, 12 months with an army or marine unit, and they will tell you the same thing. They'll tell you that over that time, they never saw an Afghan woman in Afghan government-controlled areas and areas occupied by the Americans. And if they did, it was because you surprised them and they ran back into the home. You know, I imagine the 2 I saw, this was in Zabul province in Kalat, I imagine the 2 women I saw were out together without a, and they, I can't remember if there was a man or not with them. I'm sure there probably was, but you know, they probably had some extenuating circumstances or there's something going on, they would do this. So it really, the thing I think to understand is that, yeah, this commentary on caring about Afghan women, it rings really hollow when you look at where has this commentary been when this government was allowing these things to happen, you know, as well as too, everything we know about what the American government has said has been a lie. You know, so now we're going to believe them that they were there to support the Afghan women, you know, yes. And there's lots of other human rights issues too with this Afghan government as well.
Yeah, and like I said, I mentioned the Hazaras because, you know, I think they may have a tough go of things with the Taliban in power, but I see some people talking about it, but I see some people that are just unaware of these issues. JP, do you want to comment on the issue of I do think there's a lack of understanding about Afghanistan and its people. And I don't even think the press has necessarily covered it that well. I wanted your thoughts on that.
So is your question a rhetorical question about the lack of knowledge of just about anything outside of the bubble of the United States by both the United States populace or the media? I mean, the American people knew nothing about Afghanistan when the war began other than the sort of the catchphrases about the Taliban and Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. The same thing is true about Iraq. You know, what's, I think it was 68% of the American people believed that Saddam Hussein was functionally part of 9/11 attack. So that the American people don't know anything about Afghanistan, I think surprises no one on this call, and I'm sure surprises no one in your audience. That they don't know about the Hazaras, they don't know about the women's rights, that they don't know about the tribal nature of Afghan society, that they don't know about the history of Afghanistan. They hear about it being the graveyard of empires, but they don't really know what that functionally means. They don't really know much about what happened in Afghanistan during the Cold War outside of maybe watching Charlie Wilson's War. So what they know about it comes from Tom Hanks playing Charlie Wilson. You know, this is sort of this intersects with something that struck me when Matthew was talking, because I think one of the things that we're seeing over the last week is the strangeness of the hand-wringing that comes when you lose a war on foreign soil, you're ejected, and it's a shit show, because folks, when you lose a war on foreign soil, it's going to be a shit show. And the strange hand-wringing that goes along with exiting a war that doesn't seem to have any moral or ethical basis. And Matthew was talking about his moral and intellectual crisis dealing with his participation in the war on terror. And I think this is where the intersection with Vietnam makes a lot of sense, because Vietnam was another war that turned out to be morally, ethically, and even diplomatically bankrupt at the end. And when we exited, America went through a lot of soul searching. It kind of led to a lot of cocaine and disco and some really great movies. A lot of great movies came out of that soul searching. And then the Gulf War came and we turned off the soul searching. We cleansed ourselves of all of those crimes. And here we are repeating the process again. And I think one of the reasons why you have such a high suicide rate associated with Vietnam, the post-Vietnam period for Vietnam vets, and a high suicide rate now in the American military, is that we have sent young men and women, young men and women, very young men in Vietnam, a wider age range for the war on terror, into a war that seemed to have some kind of basis at the beginning of it, but at least in Afghanistan, to go in and get to for either, whether it was for revenge or actually a justifiable police action to take out bin Laden, there was some sliver of justification for going into Afghanistan to do that. But once it became an occupation and the occupation ground on and on and on, but from Bush handed off to Obama and then Obama engaged in double tap drone strikes. If you're not familiar with a double tap drone strike, our brilliant military planners realized that if you strike a target with your drone, what will happen is the compatriots of that target will flood out to the target site, to the bomb site, to try and rescue or assess. And then you can fly back around and tap them again, double tap. You can hit them again and inflict even more casualties. So by the time we got into the Obama's surge and that part of the Afghanistan war, and once Osama bin Laden is killed, all of the fig leaf is gone. There's no justification there. And so what you see, I think now, troops have been dealing with this coming home, as I mentioned, with suicides. People like Matthew have been soul searching about their participation in it. And I think what you see now is the American people and the media trying to figure out how to process what looks to be, after 20 years, a needlessly bloody and costly adventure, trying to occupy a people we knew nothing about and really spent no time trying to understand.
Matthew, do you want to add to that at all? Or?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. You know, the double tap strikes are a great example. We also targeted funerals, you know, and we targeted first responders as well. And part of the counter-terror strategy, you will hear the official explanation, because Joe Biden brought this up on Monday when he lied so clearly and so easily and so breezily, you know, when he starts off his talk on Monday, and he says he opposes the Obama surge in Afghanistan in 2009, which is a clear lie, flat out lie. Under Joe Biden's plan that he offered to President Obama in 2009 for the surge in Afghanistan, as I said earlier, we had basically a 250,000 man army in Afghanistan. Under Joe Biden, we've had 240,000 men in Afghanistan, men and women in Afghanistan. I mean, Joe Biden's plan was 10,000 less troops than what Obama decided to do. You know, and I think that is a really great example of how you can sum up how these wars not only are started and sustained, but how the narrative on them, because a man like, something that is so easy to fact check. I mean, just go and look at what, you know, ABC, NBC, CNN say about this in 2009. It's right there. Joe Biden's plan to send 20,000 troops. But he can go on American television right after the Kabul has fallen to the Taliban. The United States has lost this war, or at least this phase of the war. And lie so easily about it. And the same thing with, we weren't there doing nation building. Lie so easily about it. And then by extension, like what JP was talking about, the drone strikes, how many years did the United States say that we weren't killing any innocent people in our drone strikes, that we weren't killing civilians, that our drones were 100% accurate, and not just some unnamed source, but people like John Brennan, the former director of the CIA, going on television and saying this. And now, and then, you know, to really kind of, you got to keep pulling the skin off of this thing, you know, and kind of looking at it. John Brennan goes on television, lies about this and many other things, and he gets rewarded with a television contract. I mean, like, so to understand, I think, this war, you have to understand how the moral dissonance, the moral mendacity of it extends not just through the military, not just through the State Department, CIA, but through all aspects of American society, especially the media and our elected officials, because you know, how else can you explain a newspaper like the Washington Post, which publishes the Afghan papers in 2019, which you know definitively detail how this war was one systemic lie from the Bush administration through the present, and then they run op-eds and they run news stories that completely contradict or go along with the narratives, go along with the lies that they exposed in their Afghan papers. I mean, like, how else do you explain that but understanding that there is very little moral underpinning to anything that has to do with American foreign policy and anything that is ancillary or connected to it?
I just wanted to add to that and also to get your take on this, Matthew. You know, a lot of people will always talk about the president did this, the president did that, and I understand that. But, you know, people have often said that the reason we didn't pull out of Afghanistan was simply because no one wanted, you know, the fallout to be on them. I think it may go deeper than that, though. I think, you know, you have a military, you have intelligence agencies that I don't think were keen on pulling out and probably would have pushed back against any president doing that. We're seeing a lot of pushback against Biden now. I wanted your thoughts on that, though.
I think you have to understand the United States as an empire and understand how the empire functions. And you go back to after World War II, when George Kennan, who was the State Department officer, who was credited with authoring the containment strategy of the Soviet Union, he says in 47 or 48, I can't remember off the top of my head, he says, you know, look, the United States has more than half the world's wealth and less than 5% of the world's population. This will be the primary responsibility or obligation of every successful administration to maintain that inequality. I mean, I think you can look at the empire shows itself in terms of how the people who populate it think differently. Under Bush, you have neoconservatives from the Chicago School who believe that the expansion of the empire is necessary because this is part of a neoliberal experiment, American exceptionalism, what is good for rebuilding or the benefit of expanding the empire will be of a benefit to the United States, right? That so you have people like Zalmay Khalilzad, Paul Wolfowitz, you know, these people who believe that, you know, one of the purposes of empire is extraction, and that if we expand the empire, we can extract more. That argument doesn't really hold, I think, for Afghanistan, certainly holds for Iraq. I think with Afghanistan really was about getting revenge, making the president look like he is strong, trying to undo the humiliation the Americans suffered, as well as punishing those who rebelled against the United States. We have to remember 9/11, everything you can say about it, the hijackers were very clear on why they attacked the United States, right? Because of U.S. sanctions and bombing of Iraq, U.S. forces present in Saudi Arabia, and U.S. support for Israel occupying Palestine. I mean, so whether or not you agree with that, that's another thing, but those are actual, that you can say, okay, I understand where they're coming from. This is why they did it. You know, so you get up to the point where maybe you have in a Trump administration a different form of, you know, guardians of the empire, for lack of a better term, when he puts into power people like Kelly, Mattis, McMaster, who do not believe in the neoliberal extractionist kind of methodology or purposes for the empire, but believe that these are the frontier lands, the borderlands. These are uncivilized areas that must be kept down, that, you know, the CIA and special operations guys use the term mowing the grass, you know, so that these will always be areas that will be difficult, that must be subdued or subjugated. And you can kind of get that if folks remember, you know, the thinking where this comes from. And I think these two books reflect the thinking that was present in the 90s at the conclusion of the Cold War, and that also then too justified this thinking and taught people, you know, Sam Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, which I think influences men like McMaster, Kelly, Mattis. There's other books too. There's a book about the Korean War that all Marine Corps officers were at one point required to read, T.R. Fehrenbach's This Kind of War, which is a history of the Korean War, but which protects the American military and especially the American Marine Corps as the modern day Roman legions on the periphery of empire, keeping the citizens safe from the barbarians. This is how these people really think. Go and read things from Jim Mattis. Go and read things from John Kelly. Hear what H.R. McMaster says on, you know, Meet the Press or wherever he is. This is what they're saying. You know, meanwhile, then you have Francis Fukuyama's end of history. And, you know, that the American Western liberal democracy and capitalism are the pinnacle of history. Nothing will ever surpass it. We are at the top. And I think that's where you get, you know, men like Collazon and Wolfowitz with their views of the empire and what their responsibilities are, you know. And then, and so I think there's a lot of philosophy, you know, in trying to understand, you know, I didn't even touch on the democratic side of it, what the Susan Rices, the Sam Powers, those kinds of people, how they play into the empire and what they view their responsibilities are and how it should conduct itself around the world. But it's, you know, certainly I think these discussions are really important to have because it just shows that there will be no lessons learned from Afghanistan. There will be no lessons learned from Iraq other than how to do these wars more effectively or more efficiently. And we've seen that because the United States in its wars in the Muslim world from Western Africa all the way to Pakistan now conducts these wars using CIA special operations and drone forces, all of which are secret and covert. They utilize contractors, which are not accountable to the Congress or to the American media or the public. And they use proxy forces because, yeah, let's let these black people and brown people die and bleed because no Americans are going to care about that. So though that's the, I mean, we can't say the American military and government hasn't learned its lessons. It has. It's that it needs to conduct these wars without showing them to the American public.
So JP, something I wanted to mention to you, and I'm glad that Matthew brought up the end of history because, you know, thinking about Fukuyama's end of history, I'm also thinking about what you said earlier about, you know, now the American people and the media are having to sort of reckon with another Vietnam type situation. It's just interesting to me that we, as you said, Matthew, maybe haven't learned the lessons that we should be learning. We're learning different lessons instead. I wanted you to comment on that, JP.
You want me to comment on Fukuyama, who's basically spent the last, 15 years trying to remediate his great blunder in the end of history and the last man, which I actually cited in my graduate thesis as an example of incredible hubris and thinking. I don't know where to go, which way you want me to go with all that. I would like to talk a little bit about what Matthew just talked about, because there actually was an imperial predicate and an extractive predicate behind Afghanistan that doesn't get talked about very often. I do think one of the reasons why we stuck around in Afghanistan as long as we did was because of Bagram Air Base. Bagram Air Base is probably the most strategically valuable air base the United States has ever held in its imperial era. Because you basically had a massive air base with incredible power projection capabilities right in the middle of Central Asia. And to reference another book from the 90s, how about Brzezinski's The Grand Chessboard? And Afghanistan has always been seen as kind of the strategic high ground in Central and East Asia. And if you look at Bagram Air Base, you're basically putting American military capabilities right in the dead center of its strategic erogenous zone. Basically, you have Iran to the west, you have the Soviet Union and the former Soviet Stans to the north, you have China to the east, and you have India and Pakistan to the south. Not to mention the fact that there was a pipeline that has long been coveted called TAPI, Trans Afghanistan-Pakistan-India pipeline, that was going to come out of the Caspian Sea oil and gas reserves and deliver those into the Indian Ocean, and that was going to be under the sort of the auspices. Chevron was seeking this pipeline route. This is after the pipeline route that was originally planned for the Caspian Sea was going to go through the Caucasus region in the 90s. When I was at the Center for Defense Information, this is one of the things that I was doing a little bit of research on back at the end of the 90s, beginning of the turn of the century, beginning of the 2000s. And that pipeline actually never materialize. It was going to go out of the Caspian Sea region through the Caucasus, down through Turkey and into the Mediterranean, and put this massive oil and gas reserve in the sphere of influence of Europe. Well, Samuel Basayev, who had led the first Chechen rebellion, who was a Islamic fundamentalist of some note and was getting some funding from traditional Islamic fundamentalist funding sources, Saudi Arabia, wink, 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 Saudi Arabia, that scuttled that plan, took that pipeline off of the drawing table, and kept the Caspian oil and gas reserves from being exploited to the extent to which many people would have liked to have seen it exploited. Maybe people who are not called Saudi Arabians, because you put all that oil and gas online coming through Europe, maybe things get traded in euros with Turkey there, you never know. And maybe that bites into the Saudi Arabian control of OPEC. So there's an extractive thing that was happening there. But then also, you know, today on the rundown, I feature two stories on the rare earth minerals of Afghanistan. And this is one of the reasons why Eric Prince, who remade himself as kind of a pasha to be, a colonial style governor, he was pitching himself to the Trump administration. Look, I know you want to get out of there, Donald. And since I'm so intimately involved in everything that's been going on in your presidency, going all the way back to the meeting in the Seychelles with Kirill Dmitriev of Russia and Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates, I think it would be really great if you turned Afghanistan over to me in a private military force, and we can kind of govern Afghanistan, and we can control the access to those rare earth minerals, those rare earth minerals that countries like China covet so deeply, and they covet them because China, which has been the world's leading producer of solar panels and renewable technologies, at least in the mass market sense of it, not in the technological edge sense of it, but leading technological edge, they would love to get their hands on those rare earth minerals, which is one of the reasons why China is playing so nice with the Taliban right now. And one of the reasons why I think Donald Trump was continually convinced to relent on his push to try and pull the troops out, because he was being told, well, Donald, you're a deal maker, and you know, and you got this thing going with China. If you pull the troops out, you know, America is going to lose out on $1 trillion estimated. That's one of the estimates. I've actually seen estimates as high as $2 or $3 trillion worth of rare earth minerals that are available to whoever is going to exploit them. And if the United States isn't going to exploit them, Donald, China will. Now, I think that's probably what the military people were saying, but I think Mattis and Kelly and McMaster, as much as they may not have been on board with the neoconservative project of sort of the American exceptionalism-based global empire, they certainly understood the value militarily of having Bagram Air Base, which was basically a Diego Garcia right in the middle of all of America's primary military interests, national security interests. And so I think that's one of the things that sustained U.S. presence in Afghanistan past the killing of bin Laden, who, by the way, was not killed in Afghanistan anyway. So I think all of this, when we start talking about these sort of nuts and bolts issues, I think what comes to mind for me is something else that Matthew was mentioning, and that's the difficulty that the American people have in understanding the rationale for being there in the first place. And I think when you look at the media, which has largely aided and abetted, I mean, it's largely, that's kind of, I'm being generous, has aided and abetted American empire forever. I was gonna say since television started to send signals out across the airwaves.
I was gonna add to that real quick, JP, especially that, you know, everything is just embedded journalists. You know, everything. They're servants of the empire. They're part of it now.
So now that you say that, you know, when I was in DC for 9/11, and I was in DC for the lead up to the Iraq War, and because I was interested in these issues, I can't remember where I was working at the time. I don't think I was at ABC, at the ABC affiliate WJLA or not, but you know, you get a lot of stuff, a lot of flyers and books and blah blah blah. And this one flyer came across my desk one day, and it was MRE, military reporters it was a military reporters organization, MRE. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. MRE, meals ready to eat, because that's exactly what the military feeds journalists who work with the Pentagon. And this MRE thing was being hosted by the Pentagon, and journalists who were working on defense issues could come to the Pentagon and have a seminar all day long. They'll feed you and we'll talk to you about how to report on the military, and we'll give you pointers. Yeah, we'll give you MREs, meals ready to eat. And there's a thin line between embedded and in bed with. And that's, you know, I look at Barbara Starr, for example. How does Barbara Starr get the information she gets? Well, because she's fed meals ready to eat. And as long as she's getting those meals ready to eat, she gets airtime because CNN says, well, we've got this insider. So, former general and now Secretary of Defense Austin, when Barbara Starr asked her a question the other day, I noticed in the press conference, he called her Barr. Well, Barr, you know, as I've been saying, which shows how completely and totally incestuous these relationships are between the military and the reporters who cover them. Now, that makes, there's sort of a self-preservation aspect of that, because infamously, everybody who's listening to you probably knows, and I know Matthew knows this, the one person who is willing to challenge the predicate for going into Iraq before Iraq happened was a guy named Phil Donahue. And on MSNBC, he dared raise a question and he was out. And this is Phil Donahue, right? I mean, one of the great television personalities, rating pulling a host of all time, he gets axed. And I remember that period in DC in the lead up to the Iraq war, and there certainly was a fear of being called unpatriotic. And to question the war was to have your patriotism called into question. Now, one of the things that occurs to me and has occurred to me over time is that this is a two-way street, I think, between the American people, the audience, and the people who are feeding them the information. Matthew mentioned the phrase manufacturing consent that Chomsky has made so famous. And it's very hard to argue with the idea that the American people are fed a diet that is designed to create a certain outcome. On the other hand, I also think the American people, particularly after the Gulf War, kind of cleansed the American palate of all of the bitterness of Vietnam, that the American people are loath to examine the complicity of the empire that works often in their service. You know, Matthew mentioned the domino theory and Kennan and the need of less than 5% of the world's population to hold on to its 50% of share of the world's wealth. Well, over the last 35, 40 years, the American people have consumed 26% of the world's resources, despite being less than 5% of its population. That does not happen by accident. And, you know, the Iraq war was greeted by what? A massive spike in sales of Humvees around the country. Why was that? Why do you have people suddenly clamoring to own Humvees, even as Humvees are being driven over IEDs in Iraq? I think because we are also afraid of questioning the moral veracity of the empire that works in our service and in our name. Those bombs and those drones, the bombs are dropped, the drones are flying in the name of the American people. For good or for ill, that's what they're doing. And I think the American people often don't want to reflect on the crimes that are committed by the empire that serves them as much as it serves American corporations. Because I'll just wrap it up with, you know, this is one of my hobby horses here, I guess, or axes to grind. I'll mix my metaphors as much as I like, damn it. We talk about the military-industrial complex and how empire serves the military-industrial complex. But when we take something like the F-35, which I have dubbed the world's greatest flying ATM machine, because that's really what it is. It's an ATM machine, just barely flying missions and dispensing cash. It's not just Lockheed Martin that's making money off of the F-35. There are thousands of people working in factories in places like Texas who are making really good livings building F-35s and building Tomahawk missiles and building all of the material that goes into the military industrial complex. And I think, if I may use this term, and I use it, you could say evil genius, but one of the genius aspects of the military industrial complex is that it actually vests hundreds of thousands of American voters in the perpetuation of the military industrial complex because their livelihoods are tied to the success of those military industrial complex contractors, corporations, and businesses, and the bombs that they sell and the bombs that they drop.
So there's a million and one things to unpack there, and I want to get Matthew's response. I also just wanted to say, I guess the reason I mentioned Fukuyama and what I was sort of thinking in my head is, I mean, to me, you know, we shouldn't be surprised by the, you know, well, it's a shit show
right,
that's happening in Afghanistan right now, because this is the outcome of imperial hubris, in my opinion.
Yes.
I want to let Matthew comment on some of your takes, though, JP.
You know, one of the things, getting back to the intelligence, right, of the military industrial complex and their savviness is, you know, there is evidence that they choose subcontractors, that they build facilities in congressional districts that are not friendly to the military industrial complex. So we're seeing that here in North Carolina right now, where Raytheon wants to come in and build a factory, and it is in an area that, you know, is a blue area, right? So not traditionally supportive. Let me just stop. That is not true, because the Democrats are as involved in the military budget and everything as anything else. But I think you understand my point, is that there is evidence that they do try and strategically put some of their subcontracts in areas that will twist the arm of members of Congress, just as JP was saying. And I know this. I mean, I have seen this with members of Congress who are relative, who are good on these issues. You know, Jim McGovern up in Massachusetts, very progressive. You know, I mean, he's worked with me on these wars for 12 years now. However, he votes for the F-35. Because they make like a tire or something like that in his district for the F-35.
I was going to say, I think that's even,
or whatever. Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I was going to say, I think that's even true of, I know a lot of my listeners like Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Bernie Sanders, yeah, baby. Bernie's an F-35 guy for the same reason.
Yep.
Yeah. I think it was because for his constituents in Vermont, and that's not an excuse, but that is what it is. But go on, Matthew.
Yeah, no, I mean, hey, it's smart politics, I guess. But, you know, I mean, I think with getting back to the extraction, the looting that goes on, or the reasons why these wars are sustained, the economic reasons that are very clear. I mean, look, I think the Special Inspector General before I forget, actually, JP had brought up the TAPI pipeline. And just a day or two ago, one of the Taliban spokespeople told Sky News that the TAPI pipeline is a priority project for our government. I mean, so, yeah. The money involved in this, I think it was 80% of the money spent on reconstruction in Afghanistan. And I can tell you from being part of that in Iraq as well, 80% of the money spent, the $150 billion spent on Afghan reconstruction, 80% of that came back to the United States.
Yeah.
Probably half of that never left, because what I understood in Iraq and what I could see in Afghanistan was that 40% of the money that's allocated for reconstruction in these countries never even leaves the U.S. goes right to the prime contractors as overhead and management costs, right? And then, of course, you know, the contractors take their share on and on. What that means, though, is that since, you know, roughly sometime in the early parts of this century, Washington, D.C. has become the wealthiest part of the United States. Prior to that, it was Silicon Valley. Prior to that, it was, you know, I guess parts of New York, Dallas, and Tulsa were at one point because of the oil. But now, you know, six of the top wealthiest counties in the country, seven of the top 10, whatever the number is, are Washington, D.C. suburbs. And if you look at the federal budget, you'll see the federal budget really has not grown much outside of the war budget, outside of the defense, veterans, state, intelligence community, homeland security. And so I was on a podcast yesterday, actually, with Ryan Grimm, and was discussing this, and Ryan Grimm from The Intercept. And Ryan said, yeah, you know, you can make the argument that Reconstruction was successful during these last 20 years. It just for Northern Virginia and Maryland.
I think you can look at Afghanistan as a money laundering device.
Oh, you can't. Oh, you want to get, you mean
that? No, I'm just saying, you, you look at a lot, like whether it's OCO, ongoing contingency operations, or the actual defined budget. But even in Iraq, these are money laundering devices, where what you do is you take funds and you cycle them through the war, and then it cycles right back to the people who are the primary constituents of who promoting the war in the first place, the people who were promoting the war before it even started, because the money comes right back to them. You know, there is no, when people talk about money being wasted, or we threw away all that money on Afghanistan, you didn't throw it away. There's kind of a law of thermodynamics here. The money just didn't disappear. Now, some of it did, the pallets of cash, right? Some of that disappeared, although it really didn't disappear. A lot of that ended up in the hands of people, like in the Sunni awakening. Money, you know, ended up in the hands of people inside these countries for specific purposes, for very practical purposes often. You know, help us not die, and let's help us find the bad guys so that our guys don't die and your guys don't die, and we'll give you some money. Well, actually, some money in Afghanistan went to a bounty system, which is one of the reasons why a bunch of people ended up in places like Gitmo and other black sites. Is we put out a bounty and said, point out the terrorists, and the guys would say, well, you know, this other guy in this other tribe here across the valley has been pissing me off for 20 years. I'm going to go tell the Americans that this guy is an Al-Qaeda operative, and he's going to end up being shipped out of the country, and I'm going to end up with $1,000 in my pocket. Still, the money has not disappeared. But, I think
JT, let me just tell a story real quick.
Please.
I'm in Afghanistan. I walk up on two Afghans, and these guys are bickering and giving each other a hard time. And the one turns to me and says, this guy's Al-Qaeda, give me money. I mean, that's exactly what it was. So please go on, though.
So it's frustrating to me also, because, you know, this money being wasted thing, you know, to reiterate what I was saying, the money that goes to Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and all of the defense contractors, it doesn't just go into the bank accounts of the executives at the top, or the people who the lobbyists who lobby on behalf of these corporations, but it actually goes into the salaries of hardworking Americans around the country. And, you know, Matthew was talking about the congressional districts. This is something that goes all the way back to Eisenhower, and I think was part of the reason why Eisenhower gave that very famous speech, exit speech at the end of his administration, about when he introduced America to the term American military industrial complex, because it was becoming apparent to him that there was this seamlessness that was being created between voters and the military industrial system that was dominating the economy at that point, or was beginning to dominate the economy, because it does dominate the economy, because that, you know, there's kind of an iron triangle that has developed over time, where you have the industrial base here, which is basically the defense industry and the automobile industry, and they have to work, they need money, so you have Wall Street, and on the other part of that triangle, that axis, is Saudi Arabia and the Middle East and oil, and those three parts of that triangle have interacted and been the focus of American empire. I mean, you could say all the way back to FDR meeting with the king of Saudi Arabia, but as you know, we mentioned in an earlier podcast, that really becomes solidified under Nixon and the deals that were cut there. But, you know, we're a car driving country. And where does that come from? Well, that comes from easy access to oil. And where does easy access to oil come from? That comes from the U.S. empire being a guarantor of that easy access of oil. Why is the United States, why is the Fifth Fleet we have the Fifth Fleet, a fleet located in the Persian Gulf, not the American Gulf, not even the Gulf of Mexico, which is adjacent to us, in the Persian Gulf, where those darn Persians seem to want to exercise some control over the Gulf, just like we have a lot of naval operations happening in the South China Sea, where China has a lot of gall in trying to throw its weight around the South China Sea. Those Chinese, what are they doing there? Does that have something to do with the oil and gas reserves around the Spratlys in the South China Sea? Maybe it does. Yeah, you're going to say?
That's what I was going to ask you about next. I know you've commented elsewhere that you feel there may be a connection between the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the sort of empire of oil in the age of climate change. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a messy thing. Because Afghanistan is this kind of wild card now with rare earths, because rare earths are in a way out of the empire of oil for a country like China, which is so dependent on the flow of oil and gas coming out of the Middle East. Do you want to be more specific on where you want me to go with this?
Well, I was just wondering, how does this connect to the issue of climate change?
Well, you know that I think that climate, the primary byproduct of U.S. empire, other than death, which is a main byproduct and probably the most important byproduct or the most immediate byproduct over the last 55, 60, 70, 70 years, I think climate change is the other main byproduct of our empire, because the empire has allowed for the free flowing and extraction of oil at the exclusion of all other possibilities. And the control over the oil market has been a crucial aspect of this empire. And, you know, as I've said in the past, that, you know, one of the misnomers or one of the misconceptions, and it's an understandable misconception that probably a lot of Americans will have, is that, you know, we went into Iraq because of oil. And why, when they say that, they mean to go get the oil. It's like Donald Trump saying, you know, he was for the Iraq war before he was against it. But even when he was for and against it, he always thought that what we should have done is gotten the oil. We didn't take the oil. We got a bum deal out of that because we didn't take the oil.
But it's Donald about Trump, keeping the oil there.
It's about keeping it in the ground, that many of the conflicts that we have seen over the last 70 years have been about keeping the oil in the ground to do a number of things. One, you extend the life of the resource, but you extend the profitability of the resource by keeping the price of the resource artificially high. And, you know, there's a case to be made that oil may have collapsed a long time ago if the free market was allowed to reign in places like Venezuela, Iran, Iraq over the last 30 years. If they were able to trade their oil freely, it may have actually collapsed out the price of, collapsed out the oil market completely by dropping the price of oil so far below the profitability, the price point on profitability now, the break-even price on a barrel of oil for the last 7 or 8 years has been around $50 a barrel. So that means to make money on oil, the price of oil has to be above $50 a barrel. Well, you know, there was a point at which the price of oil under Obama got to $26 a barrel, which meant that oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia were just getting hammered. Venezuela got hammered. You know, people talk about the collapse of Venezuela as an example of how terrible socialism is. Well, it's also an example of what happens when a president opens up fracking in a country and drives the price of oil well below the break-even price of $50 down to $26 a barrel. And Venezuela, which was feeding its entire economy off of oil revenue, suddenly has that revenue dry up. So, you know, one of the ironies, I think, of the empire of oil and climate change is that the empire of oil, as we're getting this sort of transition point with climate change, where people are realizing that it's actually a thing, and farmers are suddenly saying, oh, no, I believe in climate change because all of my crops are dying, or all of our livestock were flooded out in the lower Midwest, for example. About 2 years ago, there's a massive flood, killed a lot of livestock, opened up a lot of eyes among farmers and insurance companies. One of the things that climate change is now generating is climate migration and climate wars. I think there's been a very strong case made for climate being the thing that started the civil disruptions in Syria. We know that climate is causing displacements in Honduras and Guatemala. And so what that's doing is creating a predicate, a new predicate for empire, which is not to get engaged in resource wars or to try and keep oil in the ground, for example, in Iraq. Now you're going to need empire to keep the climate migrants that you created with your empire of oil from breaching the wall and coming in and as climate migrants and invading your country. So it becomes another rationale for empire. And I think that this is one of the things that Donald Trump was authoring, was the idea of the empire as a garrison state. And what we need to do is have all of our troops arrayed around the border to keep all of the undesirables out who are going to come and try and take what we have. And one of the reasons they're going to be coming is because of the climate migrations caused by the empire of oil in the first place.
So, Matthew, I can tell JP when you're talking that you're frustrated with some of the way all of this has been dealt with, right? How the media has dealt with it, how Americans don't necessarily, they don't own up to their own complicity in it. You're like a good Bourdieuian sociologist pointing out that we're always complicit. I wanted to ask though, Matthew, what is your greatest frustration when we talk about Afghanistan and our intervention there? I mean, really, it goes back 40 years. It's not just 20. So,
yeah, I think it's that, you know, the lack of acknowledgement of the fact that we pick artificial start dates, that we say the war started on this date, September, history begins in Afghanistan on September 11th, 2001, you know, and then you have, there's a great survey done in Helmand Province, you know, which was a buzzsaw, which is where the American Marines and British were, you know, I think the most U.S. casualties ended up occurring in Helmand. September 11th, 2001, 10 years later, they do a survey of Afghan men because you can't talk to the women. And 92% of men in Helmand Province had never heard of 9/11 10 years after it. Right. I mean, so somehow that this war is, about 9/11. You know, I think what's frustrating is the connections between all the major industries. I mean, so much of the stuff that you guys talked about in that Empire of Oil podcast and the reporting that JP has done, you know, that explains this, that when you lay it out to people, you know, it people get it. It's easy when you lay it out. But there's, where does it begin? The fact that we don't teach critical thinking skills in education? I mean, like, where does it all begin? The fact that people don't recognize that the biggest, to JP point about climate change, you know, the biggest polluter in the world is the U.S. military. The biggest consumer of fossil fuels is the U.S. military. The biggest customer for the fossil fuel industry is the U.S. military. Look, an F-50, I just looked it up because I couldn't remember exact numbers. An F-15 can burn 23,000 gallons of fuel in an hour. You know how long is it going to take me and my Prius to burn 23,000 gallons of fuel? I mean, you think that, right, the special light bulbs I put up and the fact that I walk around with a reusable shopping bag, that that's going to make any difference? So I think it's the frustration that we think that because we can do individual things, because we can tweet something, or, you know, that somehow the system will be reformed. And it's not. And when we are on a cat, look, again, the lessons were not learned. The lessons were learned in the Afghan war, in the Iraq war. It was about keeping these wars secret, keeping the cost, let the brown and black people kill each other. Because according to most Americans, these people have been killing each other forever. Right. That bullshit. You know, I mean, so it is. I think there's a lot of frustrations about just like, I think it goes back to what JP originally said. None of us on this call and no one probably in this audience is shocked that Americans don't understand anything, you know, other than what is put on, you know, other than what they're told to understand. You know, the manufacturing of consent, right, so to speak. Look, I watch a lot of Al Jazeera English, which, they do good stuff as long as it doesn't involve Qatar. Anything involving Qatar, right? I mean, so like Al Jazeera's coverage of the Syrian war is abysmal. But in terms of who they have in Kabul right now, they're doing great work. One of the people they have in Kabul is a woman named Charlotte Bellis. And on Twitter and all throughout American media, CNN's Clarissa Ward is being celebrated, right? Clissa Ward, who was catfished by Al-Qaeda when she was reporting by Aleppo and basically did propaganda pieces for Al-Qaeda, right? I mean, for you know, if you look at how Clissa Ward right now is reporting in Kabul and Charlotte Bellis is reporting in Kabul, you can see the whole theater of American media. Clarissa Ward is in a complete from head to toe black, only her face is showing, strict Islamic garb, right? Charlotte Bellis is wearing the same clothes that she's been wearing all the time over there, and she has thrown a scarf over her head, but still, and just like both Clarissa Ward and Charlotte Bellis, blonde hair, blue-eyed, right? Very easy to tell they are not from that place. And you can see this. You look at Clarissa Ward with her getup, right? The theater of it, because this is what we have to, right? And then, I'm watching Charlotte Bellis. Charlotte Bellis was the first person the Taliban called upon in their conference, their press conference the other day. Charlotte Bellis, you can see her shins, her feet, right? Her hair is covered, her hair is spilling out of her thing. Like, so that type of theater, I get very frustrated with, you know, because that just plays into all that. And that, you know, as JP said, the chief product or byproduct of American empire is death. And the close second is climate change. And this is about survival. I mean, I have a friend of mine. He runs a small podcast out in Iowa called Podcast by George. Great guy, former journalist. And all last year he was saying, hey, it's 2020, 20 minutes to be dead by, a nuclear weapon strike from a Trident submarine. Or 20 minutes to be dead, or 20 years to be dead from climate change. I mean, and like that type of, we're not talking about abstract things or things that may or may not happen. When it comes to nuclear catastrophe, you know, we're running out of close misses. We've gotten lucky as a human race a number of times over the last 75 years that somebody did the right thing and didn't launch the missiles. Somebody did the right thing and didn't call his higher command. Somebody, you know, a Soviet officer, a naval officer in a submarine told his commander he would not launch a nuclear tip torpedo against American forces during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We've gotten lucky because of individuals. At some point, our luck with nuclear weapons is going to run out. Right. And climate change just, my God, it just, you know, it just, what more do we need? I mean, what more evidence we need, particularly when, you know, I heard a thing, Michael Mann, who is, you know, very prominent climate change person. I heard him talking on Democracy Now! About this in the sense of how bad, how overly conservative our models are. And he said with the heat out in Portland on the West Coast, without climate change, that's a 1 in 50,000 year event. But what he said, what was worse than that, scarier than that, was that with the current models we have, that heat in Portland and on the West Coast was a 1 in 1,000 year event. That's how off our climate modeling is. And, you know, how many people died out there because of that? What, 600, 700 people? The Taliban in 20 years never killed more than 500 Americans in 1 year. Yet in 1 week, climate change killed 600 Americans on the West Coast. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I think now you've got me all upset and bothered, JG. And but yeah, I'm not sure if that rant and venting made any sense to anybody, but I feel better now. Thank
you. It made a lot of sense to me. I mean, you know, I feel like we're in a whole new, it's a brave new world in a lot of ways with climate change. And to me, you know, that's why I worry about things like lack of international cooperation, because I think we need some level of international cooperation to deal with climate change. And, you know, it's funny, I wanted to go back to something both of you said that, you know, oh, we shouldn't be surprised that people don't really understand or know Afghanistan here in America. But I mean, for me, I'm just amazed by the lack of curiosity that people have. I will never cease to be disappointed when I find that people don't have a curiosity about people outside their own little world. And I actually think that's tragic in a way. It's a really interesting world we live in. And we have, you know, I find it odd how I think a lot of people when they talk about Afghanistan, and I even see people that I would say are, you know, sort of left of center, or at least I've seen liberals do this in the past few days where people talk about the Afghans as if, you know, they're like some total other. You know, they're nothing like us. And I you know, I've always been confused by that. We talk the same way about Iranians sometimes. And I mean, in the with the Iranians I've talked to and Afghans I've talked to, I think they're people just like us that share certain universal experiences. I'm not saying there aren't cultural differences, but I mean, these are human beings too. And I think that gets lost in a lot of the conversation about the differences between Middle Eastern culture and the US.
Well, coming from a perspective of media, this has been one of, you know, if you really want to get me pissed off, I have DirecTV. And so on DirecTV, I have a news mix channel. It's great. It's a quad screen. And so I can watch or have on this one screen CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and BBC World simultaneously.
I know what you're going to mention here. And I was going to ask you about it because I just want to say, you mentioned Matthew Sky News interviewing someone from a spokesperson from the Taliban. A lot of news stations are doing that now, but you're not really seeing that with the U.S. But go on, JP.
Yeah, well, I do this every once in a while. I'll post it on Instagram and Twitter. I'll take a picture and I'll say, one of these things is not like the others. And you will see, for example, when the Taliban had its first press conference, there's your quad screen. And the three cable news channels had talking heads bloviating about their opinions on Afghanistan. And the fourth in the lower right-hand corner was BBC carrying the Taliban's press conference live. So this is one of the great failings of American media, and I think it's not an inexplicable failing, is that television affords an unique opportunity to go into other countries, other towns, other villages, and other places around the world and show you how other people live, talk, breathe, eat, drink, fight, die. You can see who these people are and how they live. You can often do it live. BBC often does it live. Lise Doucette is one of the great international reporters of all time. And she never puts a burqa on and she goes into foreign countries. She's done a lot of reporting on the war in Yemen. How many Americans have seen a report from a bomb site in Yemen by an American reporter on the evening news the day that it happened? How about never? That never happens. So the most Americans don't know that the United States is functionally involved in the war and has been functionally involved in the war on Yemen, let alone seen a report live from the war on Yemen. But British viewers have, and viewers who watch Al Jazeera have, and actually viewers who watch Deutsche Welle and people who watch RFI, people who watch news organizations from many of the other countries around the world, Nikkei, they've all seen these reports. The American people never see these reports. Now, is that because there's an evil plan to mold the minds of the American people and shut out the rest of the world? I could tell you when I went into the media in DC, I went in with that feeling. I said, you know, we're run by a bunch of elitist jerks, and they are feeding the American people a bunch of horseshit pablum, and we've got to do something about it. But once I got into the media, I started to realize that they are governed by something other than an evil plan to shape the minds of the American people. They are governed by the bottom line. And the bottom line is very simple. If you show people medicine, you try to give them medicine, they turn off the television. But if you give them spoonfuls of sugar, and that sugar is often things like violence and sex scandals and the murder of the day, if it bleeds, it leads, they tune in. And so there is this unfortunate, why did Al Jazeera America die? Well, it didn't help that it had a branding issue with the name Al Jazeera, which was name was turned into mud by the Bush administration because Al Jazeera in Iraq was doing much of the interesting reporting and the shocking reporting on what was going on during the Iraq war. But also because the American people just didn't want that kind of news. I watched a lot of Al Jazeera America's reporting. They were one of the, I don't think any news organization has done reporting on the plight of Native Americans the way Al Jazeera America did. But the American people did not want to watch it. They did not care to watch it. BBC News, BBC World is carried on DirecTV, but their ratings are minuscule compared to Hannity or Gutfield. Did you see that Greg Gutfield has been Colbert now?
I want to give you a quick story. I recently tried to watch Greg Gutfield because I don't watch these talking heads. It's hard to do. I want to vomit. But you know, I was watching like 20 minutes of it and I could not stomach it. I wanted to puke. It was the most content-free thing I've ever seen. And I don't know how people watch it, but I guess it's infotainment. You know, people complain about Alex Jones, but you know, I mean, I'm not sure anyone else is much better.
And that's the thing. Alex Jones, people know his name because people tune in. I mean, ultimately, there is a point at which the audience bears some responsibility for the pablum that we yell and scream as they are being, we yell and scream about them being fed. We are complicit in this. And I think that that's one of my, as you know, this is, anybody who's ever heard me on a podcast or seen me on a Zoom call or whatever knows that I'm all about responsibility. That's just kind of my thing, because I think that we are also loath to take responsibility for things like Afghanistan. And I think that there is a bliss that comes with ignorance about things like Afghanistan and our the bubble that we put ourselves in is a protective one.
I wanted to ask you real quick, and I want to kick it back to Matthew. I know he just said he was still with us, but JP, just real quick, do you think that part of the reason there's been such a pushback against Biden's withdrawal, and I think there are legit criticisms to be made of the evacuation and the exit strategy, but I almost feel like there's a vendetta against Biden in some ways, because I'm pretty sure there's people in the press that are not very happy with Biden's approach to the presidency, which is sort of, oh, I want to be the quiet president as compared to Trump. And that has not necessarily been good for ratings.
Well, yes. And, you know, this is probably going to turn out to be, I haven't seen any of the overnights over the last week, but this is going to be good for ratings. There's no doubt about it. I also think there's a performative part of this, just like Clarissa Ward is a bit performative with her burqa on. And that's a way of grabbing ratings, grabbing eyeballs, right? Oh my gosh, here's a Western reporter in a burqa. And oh my, she's about to be beheaded by the Taliban. I think also for a media that has been accused of being inordinately soft on Biden, this is an opportunity to prove, see, we're not soft on Biden.
We're not the liberal media bias.
We're not the liberal media. So I think when they get this is kind of a softball for them, they're swinging away at it. Now, as you say, there is reason to criticize the way this has been handled. But I mean, you know, this also takes the focus on the deeper roots, as Matthew has been pointing out, that go all the way back. I mean, really, we should talk about 1979. We should talk about Brzezinski and the desire to create a Mujahideen, and how that Mujahideen, after they defeated Russia, anybody who's watched Charlie Wilson War knows, we abandoned Afghanistan after the Soviet Union was ejected. And they don't really know that there's sort of a connective tissue from Afghanistan and the end of that, the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan, to Iran-Contra. It's a thing called the BCCI scandal, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was somehow involved in funding a lot of terrorism. And interestingly enough, some of the roots of Al-Qaeda and its early funding was laundered through this BCCI, and the BCCI thing became a scandal during the first Bush administration, Poppy Bush's administration, took out Clark Clifford, one of the great scions of American foreign policy. And that started to metastasize and turn into what became to be known as Afghanistan. I mean, excuse me, as Al-Qaeda. And one of the reasons why we ended up in Afghanistan was because of Al-Qaeda. And that Al-Qaeda connection goes all the way back to the United States funding the Mujahideen in the first place. So, you know, that kind of deep reporting is just not available. And I think it's easier to focus on the scandal du jour as opposed to sitting down and explaining to the American people, well, let's get into the real roots of this, because the real roots of this then leads to a larger soul searching about the nature of American empire and governance over the course of the last 50 to 70 years. And that's the kind of soul searching that the American people are loath to sit through when they can go binge watch the latest Netflix series.
I would just add to that. I think I always tell people that, you know, I think we just need soul searching about our conceptualization of, you know, oh, American is exceptional. We can do what we want to do and we're always right. That's, you know, to me, the key to a lot of this. I mean, and as long as we don't do some self-reflexive, you know, criticism of ourselves, I think we're, you know, going down the wrong path.
Yeah, the kind of soul searching that produces a Francis Fukuyama in the first place, right? How did we get to that, to believing that history came to an end with our defeat of the Soviet Union? That's a deeply embedded thing that really goes all the way back to the founding of the country. But
Matthew, do you have anything you want to add to that? And I know we'll wrap up shortly here, but I wanted to give you some time to respond to that.
This is so fantastic to hear this and to listen to you guys like this and to be able to take part in it. You know, I mean, I think with the history aspect of it, you know, Don Rumsfeld was the Secretary of Defense after Saigon fell, but he was also White House Chief of Staff from 1974 to 75. I mean, the idea that history is far removed, the idea that somehow Vietnam wasn't relevant when the man who had been White House Chief of Staff and the Secretary of Defense at the end of the Vietnam War was now the Secretary of Defense, that somehow there's a gulf in time where this doesn't matter. And I was going to say,
people always forget that Cheney and Rumsfeld, they were known as like Team B, I think, back then. And people don't really remember that history.
And it goes farther, though, right? I mean, so I was in the Pentagon. I was a captain. I was in the Secretary of Navy's office. And so, you know, I was a Marine Corps captain. And so no one ever talked to me. But one time I'm standing there. But it was great because I learned a lot. I saw a lot, you know. And I did correspondence. I did speech writing. I did protocol. Like whatever I was a junior Marine officer on a Secretary of Navy staff. So I got to see a lot, right? I mean, I got to learn a lot and listen. And but one time I'm standing there with my friend and Rumsfeld comes walking up to us and he says, And Ashley and I were standing in front of a portrait of Eisenhower. And he says to us, you know how old I am? I worked with that guy. That's how old I am. Right. I mean, so again, like how history is connected to us. And remember Eisenhower? Eisenhower, I think Eisenhower graduated from West Point in 1910, I think is when Eisenhower graduated. I mean, there were Civil War veterans still hanging out with those guys in 1910. I mean, like, so the fact that we think that these events are so far removed from us, when no, the people that are running this country, leading this country, have direct experiences with the people from epochs that we would describe that no longer count because that was the old era. That was a long time ago. You know what I mean? So this idea of history is so important to understand. And then as well, too, the culture that exists within the foreign policy community, particularly this idea that, you know, was it Karl Rove in the Bush White House who said something along the line, we're the ones who write history, we're the ones who make the history bend to our, you know, you guys just
bend write to our reality, I think was the
Yeah, bend to our reality, and you guys just write what we do. You know, I mean, that is, you know, you look at what JP brought up about the use of the Mujahideen, these Islamist rebel groups in Soviet Union, starting, you know, the idea that we're going to use these guys to bait the Soviet Union into invading Afghanistan and give them their own Vietnam, right? Zbigniew Brzezinski's plan. The other part of that plan, the one that didn't come to fruition, was that you got to remember 78, 79, a lot of Islamic unrest all throughout the greater Middle East, right? You have what happens in Iran, you have near existential uprisings, quasi-revolutions, however you want to describe them, in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. The idea that they have, these people have, is that we're going to use these forces, this force of Islamic revolution, we're going to create an Islamic revolution or foster Islamic revolution in Afghanistan, and then that will spread into, I believe Brzezinski described it as the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union, right? And then that will cause, right, dissent in the Soviet Union to fall apart from within. You know, and then the same thoughts are in the American foreign policy community in after 89, when the Soviet Union's left. Look, we can use these forces to cause problems for the Soviets, the same thoughts, Chechnya, other places. But then it stays with us, right? Because what do we do in Syria in 2011, 2012? United States thinks that we can use these jihadist groups to take out Assad, that we're basically going to take al-Qaeda in Iraq, point them west, and use them to take out Assad without al-Qaeda in Iraq, which later becomes Islamic State, right? Without the, without the thought that we'll control them, no way are they going to do a 180, go west, cross the literal line in the sand into Iraq where they came from. I mean, so the idea is that we can control history. And then that's how I think you get to these people like Fukuyama, which reflects what people, again, like Khalilzad, Wolfowitz, those kinds of people think, you know? It's the media piece. One thing I want to bring up about the media is I have had a lot of experience with no longer anymore. I never get on anymore. I haven't been on corporate American media since 2014. But at one point in 2009 and 2010, I was doing a number of appearances with Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas. I actually knew Tom in Afghanistan. And he is not the cretin, the troglodyte, the psychopath that he appears. But I think he learned a lot. He had ambitions. He wanted to become the senator from Arkansas. And so Tom and I were on Larry King together one time. You know, I mean, like we were on Fox several times together. And Tom and I are talking, you know, he sends me a text one day or whatever. And he says, I don't think that we're going to be on Fox anymore together. And I said, why? What's up? And he said, because they just reached out to me and told me that you and I are not combative enough, that we're too cordial to one another. Right. I mean, so that was it. I mean, here you had two guys who were in the Afghan war. You're talking about it, but they're too cordial to each other. That doesn't make good television. And I think Tom Cotton learns a lot from that experience, as well as other things, too, and realizes that if I want to become a congressman and a senator, I can't be cordial. I can't be polite. I can't be sensible. I can't be a graduate of the Harvard Law School. Right. I have to be this, you know, fire breathing psychopath.
You got to be Morton Downey Jr. or the Jerry Springer show.
That's exactly right, because it's about ratings. It's, you know, I had a lot of experiences. I had my Washington Post releases my resignation letter and writes that big story on me, and I'm on the Today Show, I'm on Fareed Zakaria, et cetera, et cetera. And after a couple of weeks of it, I start getting told by producers that General Petraeus' Central Command, via a private strategic communications firm, is discrediting me. And one time I go up to New York City, Dan Rather has me up there. He had at that point, you guys remember Dan Rather Reports or whatever, like an hour long show on some cable network. Access. And Rather interviews me for like 2.5-3 hours up in New York. As we're doing B-roll, walking around, you know, Midtown Manhattan, Rather says to me, hey, I know you're right. And the reason why I know you're right about Afghanistan is because I've been there, going there for 3 decades. Okay. Before I leave, his producer comes up to me and he says, what do you think about this? And it's an email from this strategic communication firm that represents Central Command and David Petraeus. And it says basically, you know, this guy, Matthew Ho, is not who he says he is. He's misrepresenting himself. He doesn't know what he's talking about, et cetera. Basically, it says, if this is the type of person that you want to work with, we will not work with you. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, when the show is on, I'm nowhere to be seen, but Dan Rather is in Afghanistan. He's talking to generals, you know? So there's an element of access that they are very afraid of, right? They're very afraid of losing their access because the Pentagon will play hardball with them.
I'm reminded of the late, great Michael Hastings now.
Yes,
because he had access, but then he really made these generals very angry, saying things that he didn't think they'd put on the record, or they didn't.
And then Michael, the media, the mainstream American corporate media, hated Michael because Michael wrote an expose of the 2012 campaign, how these reporters were buddy buddy at the evening at the end of the day, they were all drinking together in the bar, the campaign people, and the no adversarial journalism whatsoever. And Michael was a friend of mine, and you know, and I miss him a lot. Because he was one of the best we had. And if people want to read a book about Iraq that will break your heart, read his "I Lost My Love in Baghdad." Read that book, and if that doesn't turn you into someone who realizes these wars, what they're for, I don't know what will. But you know, I think the thing with Rather was, yeah, okay, concerned about access, but to JP's point about the ratings. Which would people rather watch? Dan Rather flying around in a helicopter in Afghanistan and the potential of seeing some combat or something like that, or some dude with a beard sitting in a suit being interviewed in a suite in a hotel room in New York? You know, I mean, the ratings based, and there's a woman who, if she'd be a great guest for you guys, a great person for you guys to talk to. Her name is Ariana Bakari. She works for the Columbia Journalism Review. Last year in the fall, she had a bit of celebrity because she resigned from MSNBC, where she had been a producer, and she had a career. She's probably, you know, a career of 15, 20 years in the media. And she resigned as a conscience because she could no longer go along with the ratings-based news industry, because it's hurting our country so badly.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that. I mean, what I find interesting is people are turning to George W. Bush now. He's getting his new 15 minutes of fame where he gets to talk about the withdrawal was a bad idea and all this stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, why are the people who got this right from the beginning not on, you know, national TV? Why isn't Kelly Vlahos being interviewed on every network? You know, why isn't Andrew Bacevich being on every network? Why, you know, you guys should be on every network, because, you know, I just don't, it's mind-blowing to see that we keep turning to the people who got, in my view, everything wrong from the beginning. So
And here's the thing too, those of us who are in the anti-war community who do this for, you know, we don't get paid or anything, but who do this for a living, basically, we do have people who are backing us and who run a speakers bureau for us. So it's not like CNN and Washington Post and others are unaware of who we are. We have two people and a part-time person full-time pitching for us, and we still can't get on. I got a request from Fox Business News the other day. Obviously, they didn't know who I was. They said, "Do you have anything? Would you like this? We'd love you to come on. Can you tell us what your opinion is on Afghanistan? And could you come on this evening?" And so I said, "Yeah, sure. Here's two recent essays I wrote about it." About a half hour, 45 minutes after I wrote that essay, I sent them those essays. I got an email back. "Oh, hey, we can't do it tonight. We'll try and get back to you tomorrow." But that's the end of that, right? I mean, like, but it's true. Why is there this? Why do you have John Bolton? Why do you have Leon Panetta? Why do you have, General Petraeus? All these people who have not just been wrong about this, JG, but who have lied about it, lied to these journalists. And the journalists, of course, I mean, maybe that's it because they're complicit with it. You know, I'm sure we can get into all other discussions about this. I've had people ask me, why does Lockheed Martin or General Dynamics, why do they run an advertisement on Meet the Press? Well, I think see things like that because that helps influence who Meet the Press books. Oh, well, you know, we don't want to lose these guys as an advertiser, so we need to have Lindsey Graham or, until a couple of years ago, John McCain on every Sunday. You know, that'll keep these people happy. That'll keep the fossil fuel people and the defense industry happy, and they'll run these advertisements on our show. You know, I think there's a lot to it. There's the ratings. There's the fear of lack of access. There's the fact that these people are all friends, that, you know, particularly at the senior level, they are all friends. That I think they come out of a certain understanding of the world and the way the world should be.
They tend to come out of the same institutions and the same higher education. Like there is truth to what Ben Rhodes said about, you know, the blob, the sort of foreign policy blob. He's absolutely correct. And I mean, it's not even a conspiracy. And I always try to tell people that it's just that when you have people that are really coming out of all the same institutions, they go to the same schools, it produces a mindset that sort of exists in its own bubble.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the, you know, the Washington consensus. I think that's the phrase that is best. And these people, yeah, they as Hastings describes in his book about the 2012 campaign, you know, I mean, this is not adversarial journalism. These are people who are friends. I think there's a lot to it. I think, you know, Paul Jay talks a lot about, the journalist Paul Jay talks a lot about how 95% of the S&P 500 is owned by four or five money management banks, money management firms. I mean, like, okay, that's anyone who gets to the C level of a corporation, right? The CFO, COO, CEO level, none of them got there without understanding the unwritten rules, right? As well as the concerns of the board, how with the importance of primary shareholders, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's why you can, I mean, understand along with the fact, why does the fossil fuel industry support the Defense Department and the defense industry? Well, because they're their biggest customers, et cetera, et cetera. I think that kind of explains the linkage between maybe the media, the banks, the fossil fuel industry, the defense industry. It's not the sole reason. It's not a clear cut, perfect reason, but I think there's some substance to that argument that look, the S&P 500, again, 95% is owned by five money management firms. Like whether that is, you know, how true that is in terms of like what the consequences are in terms of what comes on our screens on CNN and Washington Post or on and printed by the Washington Post, I'm not really sure. But I also know that there's no way the Washington Post, which was purchased by Jeff Bezos for what, $200 million, Bezos has billions of dollars of contracts with the CIA and the Defense Department. There is no way the Washington Post is ever going to write adversarially without maybe a couple one-offs like the Afghan papers, but the bulk of their coverage is in line with what DOD, CIA, state would like to see. There's no way they're going to go against what their owner says. I mean, it just doesn't happen. I mean, that's naive to think so, right? I mean, yeah, so...
That's what I was going to say. I think sometimes we get, you know, we get a bone thrown at us, you know, like when Scott Horton, you know, God bless him, Scott's great. He'll get on Fox occasionally, you know, but really, you know, we're sort of the outsiders in all of this.
And I think there's another thing here too. A lot has been made of the echoes of Saigon and the fall of Vietnam. I think that curing the Vietnam syndrome has been a primary goal of the Pentagon since the end of the war, since the end of the Vietnam War. And the idea that the media played a huge part in the U.S. defeat in Vietnam, that's a through line in a lot of thinking that to this day. And the sense that's not going to be replicated, I think, has governed a lot of the Pentagon's interactions with the media. And, you know, the culture has changed as well. We've actually gone from a culture where Platoon is the best picture, what is that, 1986, to Major League Baseball games and football games being dressed in martial culture. The celebration.
Do you remember back when the war on terror started? I mean, you would go to like hockey games.
Yeah.
And they would have people propelling down from the rafters.
Yes.
Like, it was like a giant like propaganda push.
Yeah. So are you going to take this sacrosanct troop? The troop is a sacrosanct figure in American life. You got to thank the troops. You got to pray for the troops, the troops, the troops, the troops. Do you want to say that they died for nothing? Do you want to say that those young men and young women died for nothing? Do you want to point out that the blood that was spilled was basically in pursuit of folly? If you do that, that calls into question your patriotism and your commitment to the American project and really who you are as a person, because we've created this martial culture around the military. And it started with the Gulf War and it has been building ever since. And, you know, if you're old enough like me to remember prior to the Gulf War, what it was like, you know, that was the period from 1975 to 1990, 91 was a time in which the military was, you know, had to be rehabilitated. It had to be rehabilitated with movies like Stripes and Private Benjamin. It had to be rehabilitated with Top Gun. I mean, Top Gun probably did more to rehabilitate the military than just about anything. But, you know, I remember growing up at a time when the military was not seen as this amazing institution. Now it's the most trusted institution in American life. And that did not happen by accident. That is a long process of building up those credentials. And I think the folly of the Afghanistan war undermines that narrative to such an extent that it becomes kind of like it's a landmine that I don't think anybody wants to tread upon in the mainstream media.
I just wanted to add one thing to that. You know, when we talk about the troops, and I'm sure Matthew could comment on this. I find it, and I tried talking to Andrew Bacevich about this, but we didn't have time to unpack it all. I think it's interesting how we'll talk about support the troops, but you know, people I know from upper middle class families are like, my son won't go off to the war. You know, they're not getting sent back in coffin. You know, I don't see the Robert Kagan family, you know, Kagan and sending their kids off. No. And I, you know, I have friends from Greenville, PA that came back from the war with PTSD and they're messed up now. But you know, it's, I hate to say it, but I think our culture treats a lot of our troops as the expendable people in our society.
Before Matthew, I'd like to get him to think about, to comment on this too. One of the things that strikes me about supporting the troops is that we have an organization called the Wounded Warriors Project. What is the Wounded Warriors Project? It's a private organization that raises money to try and help troops who are struggling, the troops that have come home who are struggling. The fact that we actually have to have a private organization that is begging for money to try and help these people, and that it's not actually something that's built into a budget that's spending $1.4 trillion on the F-35 program, just points to the hypocrisy that you're talking about, let alone the fact that you could say that the way that we recruit is in a sense a poverty draft, because it's the only way out of a dead end life for many young people in rural and urban America.
Yeah, you know, and I wish it was the case that the Wounded Warrior Project was the only one out there. Yeah. There are lots. Many of them are scams, by the way.
Yeah. They're
very careful with that. But there are some that do great work. Semper Fi Fund, Give an Hour, the Cohen Network. These are organizations that have spent hundreds of millions of dollars, approaching on billions of dollars on veterans, because as JP said, our government's not doing enough. And here's the thing. You know, the VA is the second largest government agency after DOD. It's a $200 million organization. It's a cash cow. That's why both Democrats and Republicans have been interested in privatizing it. And, you know, best way to get the privatization is to have it underperform. You know, when Barack Obama was president, the staffing for the VA is about 350,000. There are between 40 and 50,000 vacancies that the VA was not going to fill and would not fill. I mean, so purposely, just you look at it that way, it was under-resourced, right? Because it's a cash cow, you know. But yeah, I mean, there's so much with this, the media. The smartest thing that the Pentagon did was this whole embed program. Because again, to the point of love the troops, support the troops, what you did was you took journalists and you put them for 3 months, 6 months, a year with these young men and women. And if you've been around the military, I mean, you're being around 19 and 20 and 21 year olds. Who wouldn't love that? Particularly guys and gals in their 30s and 40s and 50s. These kids are great. They're funny. They're fun to be with. You know, they do stupid shit. They make you laugh, and they you know, you fall in love with them. So to the point you're making, JP, one step further, how do these journalists then come back and write something critical about the soldiers, write something critical about the war? That would be a betrayal. So what they did with this embed program was they basically put an emotional tie between the journalists and the soldiers. I don't know if that was deliberate or that's just the way it worked out.
Oh, it was deliberate. They actually talked. I remember during the when this was being debated inside the journalism community inside DC, it was about unit cohesion. We can create unit cohesion. Everybody knows this. Guys come back from Vietnam. What got you through Vietnam? Living and dying for the buddy next to me in the foxhole. And the Pentagon realized that you could create that kind of unit cohesion with journalists and the troops they were covering, unlike the way journalists operated in Vietnam, where they had carte blanche to go from unit to unit, from one battle to the next. They could just roam around the country with their camera crew or their tape recorder, and they could do what they want. There was no time for unit cohesion. So they actually had sort of a 50,000-foot view of the war in Vietnam, and they could drop in and cover story, as opposed to the embed program that put you in the Humvee with a bunch of guys. And when you start taking flak with a bunch of guys who are basically protecting you, you have instant unit cohesion, as Matthew said, and then you have an emotional bond, an emotional tie.
And it's important to remember these people who led this war. General Petraeus writes his PhD about the media and Vietnam. I mean, the media savviness of Petraeus, who becomes, who's on the cover of Newsweek magazine. And for folks who can't really remember, who aren't old enough to remember 2003, 2004 timeframe, that's when people still read magazines. You know, that's when that, you know, you would go, if you're taking the train or the plane, you would go into the little bookshop there, or the little convenience store there at the train station or the airport, and you would pick up a magazine to read on the plane. You know, I mean, that seems very antiquated now. I get that to a lot of people who are listening, but that's what it was. So even if you're in there, if you didn't read that, still on the cover of the magazine, is this the man who can save Iraq? And there's General Petraeus. My first time in Iraq in 2004-05, I was a Department of Defense officer on a State Department team. And so I was with the Army up into Crete with the 1st Infantry Division. And those guys hated Petraeus. They hated Petraeus. And the commanding general was, he would never say anything bad about anybody except for Petraeus. And they would say stuff all the time about Petraeus about, hey, make sure when Petraeus comes, make sure he lands at the large helicopter, you know, large LZ, the large HD, large landing zone, because he's going to have those two extra helicopters full of journalists. You know, make sure you set out, you know, all the extra chairs because of Petraeus and his journalists. They hated him because of what he was, because he was a celebrity general, wannabe celebrity general. But here's the thing about Petraeus, and I think this helps you understand how and why these wars were like this, how the U.S. military functions, why people don't dissent, why people go along with it. Look, Petraeus is in command of Mosul with the 101st Air Assault Division. And he, according to Petraeus and his people in Mosul, this is 03-04, things are going well in Mosul. Violence is at a minimum, no real insurgency. The unit that replaces them walks into a complete shit show. Complete fucking shit show, and the place explodes. Turns out Petraeus and his people were lying about it. They are cooking the numbers on it. Petraeus then gets the training command for Iraq, what was called MINSTICI, Multinational Support and Training Corps of Iraq, or something like that. I can't remember. But anyway, during that time, Petraeus loses hundreds of thousands of pistols and rifles. Gone. Can't be found. Unaccountable. Right. Same time, Petraeus is training the army, and more importantly, the police forces that are filled out by the Shia militias that, you know, the civil war in Iraq is already at that point going. But this is really what turns that into a genocidal civil war, is what Petraeus does with those Shia forces, you know, putting the Badr Corps in control of the police and stuff like that. Right. In any sane society, in any type of military that actually gave a shit about performance rather than appearance, he would have been, you know, fired. He would have been drummed out, would have been reduced in rank to a second lieutenant and forced to retire or something like that. What happens, remember, October 2004, with the elections coming up between Bush and Kerry, Petraeus writes an op-ed that, if you go, you cannot read that op-ed, and I can't remember if it was the Post or the Times that published it, right? But cannot read that op-ed without understanding it as an endorsement for President Bush from the general who was on the cover of Newsweek. Is this the man who can win the Iraq war, who arguably at that point was the most famous American general in the country? Clearly was. Actually, probably no one else knew any other American generals' names at that point, who was the most popular general since Colin Powell or Norman Schwarzkopf, most consequential general since maybe Westmoreland, right? And he writes this op-ed endorsing the President Bush for re-election. You know, can you imagine anything more subversive to civilian authority over the military? And what happens? He gets promoted, becomes commander in chief, right? Of the war in Iraq, he goes on to take over Central Command, right? Becomes director of CIA under Barack Obama. I mean, like, that is what people understand in the military. They see that, they get that. If you want to rise, if you want to get promoted, if you want to have good consequential positions, yeah, you might get promoted, but guess what? You're going to be in charge of a recruiting command out in the Midwest someplace. You're not getting a combat command. You're not getting a brigade combat team. You're not getting a Marine Corps infantry division unless you go along with what Jim Mattis says, you know, right? I mean, so that, like, those incentives are there. And, you know, I mean, just kind of, I think this helps. I think most people get it, right? But hopefully kind of what we're saying here is letting people see the black and white picture, maybe now in some degrees of color. You know, it is. It's there's so much to it. There's no singular reason for all this, but when you look at it and start to put the pieces together, the puzzle pieces together, you know, I think you can understand why and how this has been such a catastrophe, you know, for the Iraqi people, for the Afghan people, but such a boondoggle for so many, right? Whether it's the suburbs of Washington, D.C., the defense industry, you know, the government itself. Wars like this are gravy trains for not just individuals, not just corporations, but for government institutions, right? Look how much bigger the Pentagon is now compared to it was in 2001, right?
So we've been going almost 2 hours now. This was a lively conversation. Just closing comments, JP and then Matthew, and then we'll close out with that. But I just wanted to give you guys a final comment with regards to Afghanistan, the withdrawal, summing it up, or anything that we missed. JP, you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you can sum up the pullout from Afghanistan other than to say that America lost, and this is a big loss. Losing Bagram Air Base, that's a big loss. That's a big concession. I think the question for me in terms of this withdrawal and the echoes of Saigon and whether this is Saigon 2.0, is this the Vietnam all over again? The thing about the Vietnam War is that it looked like America was in decline, but it didn't take long for America to refocus and reboot itself and go and elect Ronald Reagan and recharge the Cold War and have a massive military buildup, missiles and nuclear weapons. And the question is whether that's going to happen again. And what I'm afraid of is that the lack of reflection on what happened in Afghanistan and really the unbelievable crime of Iraq, where we basically committed murder and mayhem on a people that posed us no threat for no good reason. There is no justification for that war whatsoever. I think the inability of us to search our souls about this war on terror in general is the pivot point for moving easily into Cold War 2.0 and focusing all of our efforts, our ire, and our military budget on the looming specter of China, which would be make it really truly Vietnam 2.0, because that's really what happened with Vietnam. We took it on the chin and then we quickly recovered and rebooted the military industrial complex better and bigger than ever before. And that's what I fear going forward, is that many of these hawks who are flying again, one of the reasons why they're taking flight and they're so happy to be in the air circling is because China is looming right there over the horizon. And with their designs on the rare earths of Afghanistan, sets up like the perfect pivot point for yet another Cold War.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a friend of mine, a guy named Mike Ferner, who was a past president of Veterans for Peace. And Mike always says, we always have to remember that even losing wars make money. You know, I mean, so I think that's one takeaway. I think the other takeaway is like, look, right now the Taliban have been very successful. That's an understatement, I guess. But whether or not this is final victory is still to be determined. And it could be, and there could be if the Taliban consolidate power, if the West holds its nose amidst defeat, this could be the opportunity for Afghanistan to rebuild and reconcile. Because as long as there's violence going on, as long as the war is occurring, as long as the cycle of violence and revenge is ongoing, you can never rebuild or reconcile. You just can't. So this might be a very cruel, unjust, unfair peace for the Afghans, right? They've gone from, a kleptocratic regime to a theocratic regime, you know, I mean, but is this an opportunity for at least life to not be sacrificed daily, right? For misery to come to a maybe a little bit higher level than the catastrophe of the last 20 years, the last 40 some odd years. My concern, though, is that, the lessons learned, again, that the foreign policy community, the intelligence community, the Pentagon, the State Department always seems to be is like, we can do this better. Not that we shouldn't have done it, not that it was a mistake, not certainly not that it was immoral, but, and so now, I'm sorry if I said this earlier, We've been on for 2 hours and I've done a few other interviews and I'm mixing everything up at this point. So if I've repeated this, please forgive me. But the, there are people who are looking at the map of Afghanistan right now in Washington, D.C. and saying like, look, this is no different than it was in September 10th, 2001. Taliban are in power in most of the country. You've got warlords holding out in parts of the country or outside the country. We did it once on September 10th. We did it once back in 2001. We can do it again, but this time we can do it better. You know, again, the hubris, the arrogance, the ignorance that we've been describing this conversation, that's my great fear, is that that's what's going to, the Afghan people are just going to continue to suffer because of the American empire, our need for all the different things we've described over these last 2 hours.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming on Parallax Views. I think listeners know JP, the News Vandal website, newsvandal.com. Everyone subscribe to The Rundown, best newsletter in the world. And Matthew, could you let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work?
I have a website, matthewho.com. I'm not very good about updating it though. And I guess the best way to contact me or to follow what I'm doing, I guess, is Twitter. I actually got back on Twitter last week, right before all this happened, just kind of randomly. Because of that would be the best thing for my PTSD, my traumatic brain injury, and my substance abuse was to get back on Twitter. I'm not really sure what I was thinking, but I'm on Twitter. I'm at Matthew P. Ho, P as in Patrick. So you can, find me there, follow me there. We're happy to talk with people that way.
And thank you both again for coming on Parallax Views.
Hey, thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Matthew Ho and JP Satilli, and I hope you thought it was as much of a tour de force as I did. As always, if you can, please, please, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. Recently had a few more donors pitch in, and I want to thank them greatly, especially a certain someone who just gave a very healthy donation to the show. I was blown away, and it is helping immensely. I still need some more donors. I'm not scrounging for money. I'm not trying to grift. I'm just trying to survive at this point. This is my full-time job. This is basically a career for me at this point. So your help is greatly appreciated. There's a $1 tier, $5 tier, $10 tier, $15 tier. I try to update the bonus content on the Patreon page when I can. It's usually at the beginning of the month and, in the middle of the month. I'm currently posting some new content on the Patreon page, including an exclusive episode on George H.W. Bush. So that'll be very interesting and should be out in the next few days for $5 tier supporters. At the $10 and $15 tiers, you get a producer's credit shout out. And at the $15 tier, you also, if you want, can speak with me by way of Zoom or Skype. I like to make myself available and give a little bit of access to those who donate at the highest tier. And of course, if you want, you can also donate more than the $15 tier. I've had at least one person do that. It really, really, really helps out. But now we have to go and give the producers credit shout outs to the people at the $10 and $15 tiers. So let's get right to that. Producers credit shout outs to Mark, Martin, Catherine, Emilia, Mickey, Chase, Jamie, James, Brian, Orc, Spartacus, Ed, Nathan, Holland, Gratz, and the War Nerd. Please, if you can, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. We're doing good on donations this month. I am making a drive and I really need to do it because, as I've said in previous episodes, I'm taking in a family member right now and have a lot of, you know, added stress because of that. I'll put it that way. But, you know, everyone who has helped donate this month, I really, really, really appreciate it. And if you can join them in donating, even if it's just at the $1 tier, it would be greatly appreciated. So you can do that at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.